Okay, so I'll be telling you something. So the work that I've been doing with Stan on the origin of the Laplace resonances among the Galilean satellites. And in the orbits of the inner three Galilean satellites, Io, Europa, and Ganymede, are in a set of resonances with the orbital periods sort of nearly in the ratio 1:2:4. And I'll tell you what all the resonances involved are. In particular, there's something called the Laplace relation that involves the mean motions of the three satellites in that combination. And I'll also explain that in more detail later. And in fact, it's the orbital eccentricity that's maintained by these resonances is actually what leads to the sustained dissipation of tidal energy to produce the active volcanism that you see on Io, and possibly also to maintain a liquid ocean on Europa. And sort of the currently popular, there's no theory for forming the satellites in resonances. So usually the scenario involves somehow moving the orbits of the satellites which then put them into the orbital resonances. And so the currently popular way of doing that is by differential orbital expansion due to the torques from Ti's rays on Jupiter. And I'll describe that a little bit more also later in the talk. And in this scenario, basically the resonances would be assembled long after the formation of satellites, and basically could have been any time since formation to the current time when the set of resonances are assembled. And so Stan and I have been, a while back we were working on this 2:1 resonance system in an extrasolar planetary system with two planets in 2:1 orbital resonance. And in that case, sort of a natural explanation for how you form that resonance is from orbital migration due to interaction with the disk from which the planets form. So a natural question then to follow on that that same idea would be to ask the question whether the orbital resonances in this case could also be assembled primordially by differential migration of the satellites due to interaction with the circumjovian disk from which the satellites form. And so that's sort of the bulk of the talk would be about. Okay, so the first thing I'll tell you about are what are those resonances. And so just to make sure everybody have the notations for the orbital elements of a Kepler orbit, everyone knows the semi-major axis and eccentricities. And the longitude of periaps is just the angle the angle of the periaps relative to some reference direction. And what's referred to as mean motion is 2 pi over the period, which is just the mean orbital frequency going around the orbit. And what's called the mean longitude is an angular measure of where the satellite is on its orbit that's linear in time. And generally, if you have an eccentric orbit, there's no simple geometric configuration that gives you that angle. But the key thing to remember is that when the satellite is at periaps, then the mean longitude is the same as the longitude of periaps. And when it's at apoaps, then it's the same as the longitude of periaps plus 180 degree. Okay, so what are the orbital resonances? So when you're at a when you say that you're at a 2:1 mean motion resonance, naively, I guess what you would say is just say that so you have the orbital period or the mean motions having a ratio around 1:2. For the so this is 1 and 2 are the inner and outer satellites, and so that translates in terms of the mean longitude is telling you that lambda 1 minus 2 lambda 2 is about constant, but that's not quite right because you have satellites that are interacting, so the orbits are precessing. So dynamically, the significant combination of frequencies when you have coplanar orbits are in fact actually n1 minus 2n2 plus the precession frequency of either the inner orbit or the outer orbit. And so what that translates into is that you have these two eccentricity type mean motion resonance variables. And so you have lambda 1 minus 2 lambda 2 plus the longitudinal periaps of either the inner planet, inner satellite, or the outer satellite being the two mean motion resonance variables. Okay, so what you would then say is that if one of these variable is oscillating about some value, then it's in libration, and that's a, then it's actually is that particular resonance variable is in resonance. The alternative would be in circulation. Then the angle would just vary between 300 between 0 and 360 degree. And the other thing to point out is that if both of those mean motion resonance variables are in resonance, then the secular resonance variable, which is just the difference of the two angle, which is also the difference of the longitude of periap, so it's the angle between the relative orientation between the two orbits. And so if those two are live in resonance, then that's also in resonance. Okay, so what are the resonances in among the Galilean satellites? So what I'm going to be numbering is Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto, going outward would be 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so in the case of Io and Europa, actually both of those 2-to-1 mean motion resonance variables are librating, with theta 1 librating about 0 degree and theta 2 librating about 180 degree. And for the same two mean motion resonance variables for involving Europa and Ganymede, theta 3, which is the one with lambda 2 minus 2 lambda 3 plus the longitude of Europa, that one is in libration about 0 degree. But the other 2-to-1 resonance variable involving the longitude, periaps longitude of Ganymede, that one is not in resonance, it's circulating. And the fact that this theta 2 and theta 3 are both librating tells you that the difference of these two angles, something called the Laplace angle, is librating about 180 degrees. So that's the combination lambda 1 minus 3 lambda 2 plus 2 lambda 3. And so if you look at that, take the time derivative of that, that was what I previously wrote down as Laplace relation, is sort of n1 minus 3n2 plus 2n3 is 0. To geometrically, I guess the more important thing is to understand what the geometrically, what it actually is doing when you have these resonances. And so what you can ask yourself is, of course, so if theta 1 and theta 2 are librating, both librating, and so that secular resonance variable is librating about 180 degree, that tells you that the orbits are anti-aligned. And from these two conditions, that theta 1 is 0 and theta 2 is 180, you can ask yourself where the Io and Europa has to be at the time of conjunctions. And what you find out, so the dash here indicates the where the periaps are. And so the orbits are anti-aligned of Io and Europa, and the conjunctions happen when Io is at periaps and Europa is at apoaps. And if you look at the resonances involved, the resonance involving Europa and Ganymede, only one is in resonance and the other one is not. And what you find out, again, from those conditions, you find out that at the time of conjunctions of Europa and Ganymede, Europa is at periaps. Ganymede could be anywhere on its orbit relative to its periaps, and Io has to actually be on the opposite side of Jupiter.
The axis of this, long axis of this different orbits are on the same direction?
Say that again.
So the periaps, the direction of the periaps, are they basically aligned with each other?
Okay, so here's the... So they are aligned, but they are all precessing in space. So if this starts, which I guess is not. There. Okay, so this is showing you starting at the epoch of the conjunction of Europa and Ganymede. So it's now going through slowly through one period of Ganymede, and then it will go faster, and you would see that. It's going to speed up. So now you see that these two are anti-aligned, and they have to keep anti-aligned, so they precess together. But they are both precessing relative to Ganymede, which is also precessing, but you can't quite tell on this. It's very slowly, so you can't tell on this time scale. And this precess, the rate at which this is precessing is actually the real rate at which the orbits are precessing compared to the orbital period. Ganymede is about a week. Is there a week? Yeah, that's right. Okay. All right. So as I said, there's no theory for forming the satellites in resonances. So some sort of migration scenario is usually invoked to to assemble the resonances. And so the currently popular means of assembling the resonances from initially random orbits is by differential orbital expansion due to the tides raised on Jupiter. And this was, I guess, first suggested in print by Goldreich, and then sort of a fully consistent scenario how this works was worked out by Yoder, and then later by Yoder and Peel. And so the idea is that you have the satellites raising tide on Jupiter, which causes the dissipation of that tide causes the orbits to migrate outward. And since Io is the one closest and raising the highest, strongest tide, its orbits migrate fastest. It would be moving, its orbit would be expanding faster than that of Europa, so it's gaining on Europa's orbit, and so the convergence would then result in the capture into a 2-to-1 resonance between Io and Europa. And then, so schematically, it's sort of like this, you started with Io, Europa, and Ganymede in some configuration that has no resonances, and so Io would be moving out. It captures Europa into into the 2-to-1 resonance, and then they would be moving out together, staying in the 2-to-1 resonance, and then they finally encounter Ganymede and capture Ganymede into 2-to-1 resonance with Europa. You can see that there's also because of the resonances, there's excitation of the eccentricity, and there's there are two things going on. One is that you're pushing the orbits, trying to get them deeper into the resonance, and the consequence of that would be to excite the eccentricities. There's an opposite effect, which is the tidal dissipation in the satellites tends to damp the eccentricity. And so you could achieve equilibrium in equilibrium configurations with the excitation balancing the damping. All right. So boy, this is going very fast. The other scenario that we've been looking at is the primordial origin scenario, and this was originally motivated by observations indicating that Io's orbit might be contracting rather than expanding, and the theoretical difficulty accounting for sufficient tidal energy dissipation in Jupiter. Rick Greenberg had proposed that this idea that the resonances might be primordial. And then he sort of considered the evolution of the system from much deeper in the resonances. But he never actually specified he didn't actually specify a mechanism for placing the system in the resonances at the time of satellite formation. So he just assumed that it could have happened and sort of analyzed the consequence of that. But I should say immediately that there are two. No, so the, sort of, he was sort of motivated by those two facts that I listed there. But the observational claim that about Io's orbit contracting rather than expanding is highly uncertain because it's very difficult to actually analyze. It's a very slow secular change, so it's actually very difficult to get that number out of the data. And also, it turns out that either primordial or tidal origin, it turns out that it actually doesn't get around this problem about the constraints on the amount of tidal dissipation that's needed in Jupiter. And so you actually haven't, even if you are in favor of primordial origin, it doesn't get around the having Jupiter having to have sufficient tidal energy dissipation in Jupiter. So what we basically sort of added to this idea was the idea that in fact the differential migration of the newly formed Galilean satellites due to the interaction with the circum Jovian disk can in fact lead to the formation of the Laplace relation. So it's sort of a specific mechanism for doing this. And so what I need to tell you about a little bit is first of all, what the this model would be in this for formation of the satellite, Jovian satellites. And so the model that I'll be talking about, that I'll be relying on, the ideas that I'll be relying on are mainly that proposed by Knupp and Ward and also by Stevenson. And the idea is the following. If you so the simple thing that you could imagine doing is basically like what you do in the in the solar nebula problem. You know, people in this minimum mass solar nebula that people often invoke, what you do is you say that you have this much mass in solid in the planets, and you add enough gas to make the overall abundance to be basically like solar abundance. And so that gives you how much mass in gas was present in the solar nebula. And if you go through that same mix, if you invoke that same idea for the satellites around Jupiter, and try to sort of compose a minimum mass subnebula around Jupiter, again, sort of taking the masses of those Jovian satellites and add enough gas to produce roughly a solar abundance. What you find is that you have a very fairly massive disk that has very high surface density and very high surface temperature. And you run into the problem that so the temperatures would be very high, and then the rate at which the satellites form would also be very quick, rapid. And then you would have a hard time trying to explain the observed properties of the Galilean satellites. And the ones that I've listed here in particular are the fact that both Callisto and Ganymede have something like 50% of ice by mass. And so if the temperatures are too high, then you have trouble forming things that have that much ice in it. And the other fact is that the Callisto, the current indication is that Callisto is maybe only partially differentiated. And for that to be true, you need Callisto to grow on a fairly long time scale. And so that's running into trouble with this accretion rate being too fast.
How big is the disk relative to Jupiter?
I think it's like 2%, isn't it? Or it's of the of that order, of the mass of Jupiter. Yeah.
Okay. What are you using for the accretion rate? I mean, what's making it? Is the standard alpha disk with alpha?
Even if you consider very low alpha, so I think they went through a range of numbers, and even if you go to the low number of something like 10 to the minus 4, it's still very, you still have this problem.
Okay.
So the idea that they have was sort of getting away from this minimum mass subnebula model is, and instead sets that the satellites, in fact, form near the end of Jupiter's formation. And what happens is that the picture that a lot of people have in Jupiter formation is that when it grows to about close to its current mass, when it's massive enough, it could actually open up a gap in the gas disk around the sun from which the Jupiter forms. So there's a gap in the solar nebula, and when it opened up a gap, there you would still have material flowing in to Jupiter, but because of the gap opening, the flux of material is now significantly lower than pre-gap opening. And so you're then in a situation where the surface mass density of the accretion disk is now much lower than in the case of the minimum mass subnebula, and also the temperatures are much more reasonable. And what happens in this case is that at any one time, there's actually not, so because you by default you now have a disk that has significantly less mass than in the minimum mass subnebula, so at any one time you don't have enough material to form the satellites, and so you would have to have an accretion disk over many viscous time scale, and so you have to process through the same amount of material to build up the satellites. But at any one time, there's not that amount of material in the disk.
Would this give a different interior temperature for Jupiter? I could see if you had a big ball of gas and you let it collapse, and you get something very hot. But if you just let stuff dribble onto the surface, you get something much colder. So the temperature today might be different. Is there a limit where you have to have some certain amount of it collapse initially? And then...
Well, there's this issue about, because you need, if you have actually high accretion rate onto Jupiter, then its radius is actually large. And in fact, I think that's part of the problem with also, if you actually have a high accretion rate, then you actually ended up with Jupiter actually certainly could be of order the size of the, orb of where the Galilean satellites actually are. And so you could sort of do this sort of backward. You could say that you really have to wait till the great accretion rate has come down before you can be in the situation where you can form the Galilean satellite, because Jupiter has to be able to contract sufficiently.
This low accretion rate only happens at the very end. Jupiter has most of its mass.
Right.
So whatever its history was before determines what the structure will be. And this is a Jupiter shrinking.
Okay, so unlike Jupiter, which I just said that most people think this mass, at least when it's close to its final mass, is big enough to open the gap in the disk in the solar nebula disk. The satellites are not that massive compared to Jupiter's mass is not that massive, and so they are probably not able to open gaps in the circumjovian disk. And so the migration of the satellites due to interaction with the disk is through something called a type 1 migration. And so this is what I wrote. So this is the migration rate A dot over A. And so if there's some constant times, so the key thing here is that it has dependence on the mass of the satellite. It has a dependence on the disk surface density and sort of orbital frequency and the dimension of scale height. And so one thing that also happens with a lower mass disk is that you now also have significantly prolong the migration timescale. And so things can stay around a lot longer without having problem that they would just migrate into Jupiter. And so given this form of the dependence on the mass of the satellite, if let's say if I for now assume that the A dependence on the other factors are reasonably weak, then the migration rate A dot O dot A would be proportional to the mass of the satellite. And so, and since Ganymede is the most massive of the Galilean satellites, then there's a chance that if you are in this situation, then Ganymede's orbit would be the one moving the fastest toward Jupiter. And so it would be converging on the orbits of Europa and Io. And Callisto is the one furthest out, but it's moving slower, so it wouldn't be catching up with Ganymede. And so you have a situation, so there's a situation where you you could be in a situation where, in fact, Ganymede's orbit is converging on Europa and Io, which then could capture them into the resonances, and not having Callisto in the resonance, in any resonances. All right, so. The paper that we initially wrote on this was a demonstration of the possibility that this could work. We demonstrated that in fact we could get capture of Io, Europa, and Ganymede into the resonances with the orbital periods in the ratio 1:2:4, and the model that we did was we just did something fairly simple. We just assume that the satellite have their current masses, basically. We didn't make any assumptions about mass growth during the migration period. And we assume that the migration rate is something that goes like the mass of the satellites. And then in addition to, the satellite disinteractions, in addition to making the satellite migrate, it also damped the orbital eccentricities. And so we put in a damping rate, E dot over E, which is something of the order of 30 times the migration rate.
So what is the physical relation to this type 1 migration?
It's essentially there's gravitational interaction between the planet, between the satellite and the disk. And there's an asymmetry, so there's gravitational torques between the disk and the satellite. And the net effect of that is there's an exchange in angular momentum. So the net effect of that on the satellite is to cause it to migrate inward.
What happens is that each resonance on the disk will be motion of the satellite. Creates spiral density waves. The distribution of mass in those waves leads to the torques. So at each resonance, there's a set of spiral density waves, and that then leads to a torque on the object. And the ones outside we go in, and the ones inside try to push it out with the distribution of mass in the waves. And the outside ones win. And that first factor up there, that C sub A, with the asymmetry factor.
The other extreme was when if you're in the gap opening situation, then you've opened up a gap, so you basically are co-evolving with the disk. So then the migration timescale is the viscous timescale of the disk. So that's what's called a type two migration. That's type two migration.
Okay.
Yes. So that.
Is the eccentricity of the orbit essential in this, or even if it's a round orbit, it's still going to migrate?
It will. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. If you have a circular orbit, it's still going to migrate. But if you have an eccentric orbit, then there's the additional effect. It would actually damp the eccentricity of the orbit. Okay, so this is sort of the calculation we did, and so these are actually just four body integrations, I guess. And what we did was, in addition to just the gravitational interaction between the satellites and Jupiter, we also put in by hand terms that mimic the A dot over A. So there's a term forcing the orbits to migrate inward, and then there's also a term that forced the orbit eccentricity to damp if they are eccentric, based on the ratio that I mentioned earlier. And so what we have here is that we are starting with Io Europa Ganymede, again, at some configurations that are not in resonances. And so we have Ganymede moving faster than Io and Europa. And so it's approaching, so Ganymede is approaching Europa. And you can see that the ratio A2 over A3 is increasing until it reaches the ratio for the mean motion ratio of 2:1, and it's captured into 2:1 resonance there, and there's an excitation of the eccentricities, and then they move together, keeping in 2:1 resonance and keep catching up with Io, and eventually catching Io and Europa in 2:1 resonance, and so this is the so at the end you see. There's an equilibrium again because the eccentricity has reached sort of equilibrium because of the damping that we've put in. But the values here are, the eccentricity here are significantly larger than the current values of these eccentricities.
So the initial spacing you pick randomly?
It's basically randomly. I actually have a plot later about doing random statistics based on random runs. Okay, so this is from the same calculation, showing you what these resonance variables are doing. So remember, so theta 1 and theta 2 are the two mean motion resonance variables involving Io and Europa. 3 and 4 are the one involving Europa and Ganymede, and 5 is the Laplace angle. And you can see that at the end of this calculation, everything, all of the resonance angles are in libration. And so it differs also, so it again differs from the current configuration in two ways. One is that theta 4 is in libration. Remember, theta 4 in the current situation is circulating. And the other interesting thing is that it has these, instead of having these angles librating about either 0 or 180 degree, they're librating about some odd angles like minus 30 degree and 80 degrees. And so what that tells you is that it's in a configuration where, for example, the apsides they're not aligned or anti-aligned, but they maintain a certain angle while they're precessing. And we have seen this sort of thing when we've been doing other calculations about 2:1 resonances in extrasolar planetary system, and we also see configurations like this when you have sort of non-negligible eccentricity.
So I'm confused. So in your model, is there mass between each of the moons at this point still, or is there, that's already been cleared out and you just have
what we are doing is that we don't actually have a disk. What we do is that we put in by hand sort of effects, what we think is the effect of the disk on the satellites.
Yeah, sure. So that means that in essence there's still a mass there.
Yeah, so up to this point, there's still, so this part of the calculation is through the whole phase when there's this around.
Okay.
And so that's the next part is, so what happened after the this disperse is that the migration basically stops, but you again still have orbital eccentricity damping by tidal dissipation in the satellites. And in particular, because actually at the end of the previous phase, the eccentricities are quite high, so they actually could damp quite, there's a large amount of damping going on. And so what we have done here is a calculation where starting from the end configuration from the previous plot, what we did was we just put in eccentricity damping in the, I think this one is just with in Io, right? Yeah, so, you can see that slowly the eccentricities off because they keep locked in resonance. So when you damp one eccentricity, you actually damp all three of them because they have to adjust themselves to the right configuration. And so all three of them are slowly declining. And by the end of this calculation, the eccentricities there are more basically the currently observed values.
But when you take all the mass out, where does that angular momentum go? Does it go into these minimums?
You're actually conserving angular momentum, but dissipating energy. For this effect.
You want the angular momentum to do this?
Yeah, so
it depends on how it's removed, of course, because there are various techniques for being built. Some of it is viscous dissipation, or it just goes, you know, you spread it out and drive some of it into Jupiter. And the other techniques are photo evaporation, where the angular momentum actually goes into the photons.
But in these models, the angular momentum never goes into the moons at all. It just the same.
From the disk, no. It's sort of highly idealized, and since we have a disk once and migrate to the point in the southern node of the disk, and then it's a bit.
Well, we do have the angle. Well, the fact that it was migrating in a previous plot was the angular momentum exchange with the disk.
Sure.
But what we didn't take into account is that the step, what we didn't take into account the details about how the disk dispersed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much mass is that? That's
So there's very little and as I said, because it's you're not in these disk models, there's actually very, very little mass at any one time in the disk.
Okay. What is the expected lifetime of the disk?
Boy, I'm not even sure anyone knows about for disks around planets. I'm not sure anyone has any idea. You know, the for the solar nebula, people often talk about.
What if you use timescales that you have here?
Well, so the timescale in this plot, right, is sort of on the order of 10 to 5 years, and that's not unreasonable. But I'm not sure there's any real constraint on what that timescale should be for disk around planets.
So say if the disk existed for say a few million years, then you would expect that initially you would reach this quasi-stationary state with these large eccentricities,
mm-hmm.
and it will persist until the disk is removed for millions of years.
Right.
And then after the disk is removed.
Right. But there is also a problem that you would then have the problem that they keep in this configuration, but of course they are all moving inwards, right? So you would then have to start everything much further away, and then I think you would start running into a problem again, have to explain the physical properties of the planets, of the satellites. There's sort of a self-consistent. Everything kind of makes sense if sort of all the processes are happening at roughly the same time scale. And so the satellites would have migrated, but not by a huge amount. OK, so this was the evolution of the eccentricities due to the damping from tidal dissipation. And if you now look at how the resonance angles are evolving, so remember at the end of the previous phase, they were all librating and mostly about some odd angles. And you can see that as the eccentricity damps, they all slowly go to libration around 0 and 180 degree. And also very interestingly, actually theta 4 does actually go out of resonance as you see in the actual system. And so from this scenario, a combination of a primordial origin plus subsequent tidal dissipation, we did actually end up with a configuration that looked very much like the observed system. Okay, so somebody asked that question about sort of where we start things. And so you could ask yourself what happens if you start varying the different parameters. And we already knew early on when we wrote the first paper was that there are situations where we actually ended up with configurations that are not in the observed configurations of 1 to 2 to 4. And so here's, for example, as a calculation where we actually ended up with, so Europa and Ganymede are still in 2 to 1, But actually, Io and Europa ended up in a 7-3 resonance at the end of this calculation. And so what we did was, so here's on the right side here is a plot of what I did here was I have a bunch of calculations that I fixed the initial semi-major axis ratio of Europa to Ganymede and Ganymede to Callisto, and varies the initial semi-major axis ratio of Io and Europa. And what you see here is the fraction of cases that ended up with Io, Europa, and Ganymede in 1 to 2 to 4. And so the total probability there, there's something like 75% of the cases actually ended up with the 1 to 2 to 4 configuration. Okay, so the last part of this talk is sort of somewhat, it's basically work still in progress. So the calculation I showed you before are, so we made the simple assumption that the masses were not growing and that the migration rates are sort of on the order of proportional to the mass of the satellites. But that's sort of a very simple picture. And so what we are doing right now is to sort of put in all the extra things that you need to worry about. So we are doing calculations with the satellite masses growing as they migrate. And also there's this additional fact that when the satellites, so you have them growing, and so when they're small, you could actually be in a regime where instead of being dominated by the migration being dominated by type 1 migration, you could actually be in a regime where it's just simple gas drag that's the dominant effect on migration. And then, so we're now trying to also take into account all these radial dependence on the surface density and the dimension of scale height, which effectively the midplane temperature of the disk. So all, you know, the detailed profiles on about the disk. I guess you could almost see that picture. So again, so one of the first thing we try was we basically took one of the models from one of the disk models from Knupp and Ward. So this is a picture showing the surface density, dimension of scale height, and the temperature profiles. And in this particular case, when we use a model like this, you now have the main factor here is now that there's radial dependence in the surface density and the temperature and the dimension of scale height, and so the relative rate at which the satellites migrate is not just the masses, but it also depends on where they are in the disk. And so here's a calculation we did that, and what you see is that with that this model, we did get capture of Europa by Ganymede into a 2-to-1 resonance. But you see that after capture of Europa into the 2-to-1 resonance, Io is still moving, semi-major axis ratio of Io to Europa is still decreasing, meaning that Io is still going away from Europa. And so here's a situation where there's capture of Europa and Ganymede into 2-to-1 resonance, but that Io actually escapes capture. Okay, so if you're in this situation, sort of one possibility is then sort of more complicated scenario would be that you have the Io Europa capture into 2-to-1, sorry, Europa Ganymede capture into 2-to-1 resonances through interaction with the disk. And then after the migration that the disk disperse, then you have that set of resonance, but Io is not in resonance. And so the scenario could be that you could then have sort of a combination of a tidal and primordial origin. So then you could say that the tidal effect is now pushing Io out. And so that could then eventually push Io into a resonance with Europa and Ganymede. And so this is sort of a scenario, sort of starting what I showed you earlier in the previous plot, and and then putting in the tidal effect of Io, expanding the orbit of Io outward.
You just turn this effect on at some point of
time? Yeah, it's basically just by hand, yeah.
Although it chooses,
Sorry?
Although it's probably present during the entire evolution.
Well, the tidal effect has to, that happens on a much, much longer time scale. So while you're in the state where you're dominated by, if your evolution is dominated by this interaction, the effects of tides is probably not that important. But once that part stops, once the disk disperses, then on a much long, yeah, this is the time scale here is accelerated. So in the real situation, this would take much longer time to happen. Yeah.
So the slope of this second part of the curve would be much slower.
Yeah. In fact, I'm not even sure what the time axis is there. okay, so that's one situation where in one disk model, there's sort of partial success, so you actually need a mixture of primordial and tidal origin for the set of resonances. The other thing that we have been looking at is sort of doing basically a simple constant m dot disk, that's a constant m dot steady state disk that's optically fake. And what we find in that case is that you can sort of work out if you take the profile density and temperature profiles in that case and work out what the a dot over a is for the type 1 migration, what you find is that in that case there's very weak dependence on the distance from orbital distance of the satellite. And so in this situation, it's much more promising that, in fact, even after Ganymede captured Europa, they could still be both catching up with Io. And so here's a calculation that we didn't quite finish. And so here's based on that this particular disk model. And so we have here Europa catching Ganymede catching up with Europa, so they're in the 2-to-1 resonance, and then at that point, Europa is being pushed by Ganymede, so it's now moving faster. So now it's actually the ratio of Io to Europa is now going up, approaching the 2-to-1 resonance. But this calculation wasn't finished, so but it looks promising compared to the previous case where after the capture you would see this still diverging, but now it's actually going up to 2-to-1. Okay, so conclusions would be, so we can say is that at least some models of the Circumjovian disk can lead to the Laplace relation during the migration phase. Even when we put in all the additional effects like gas drag, time 1 migration, and mass growth of the satellites. And then the subsequent damping of the eccentricity by tidal dissipation in the satellites after the migration stops can bring the system to the current configuration. For that configuration to maintain that configuration through the age of the solar system, you still need the torques from the tides rays on Jupiter to maintain that configuration. Because if there's not enough torque, then actually the damping in the satellites could actually push the system out of the resonance. And so you still need the torques from Jupiter to maintain the resonance. And as I said, other resonance configurations can result from the differential migration, but there's a high probability for the 1-to-2-to-4 period ratio for Io, Europa, and Ganymede.
How much dissipation do you need to maintain the resonance? Is it the usual tidal Q in the air?
So it turns out really either way, the number basically is the same. You basically need QJ Jupiter on the order of 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6.
Well, why is it the same? Because I mean, in one case, I mean, the usual limit comes from pushing Io out from co-rotation with Jupiter, just all the way out into the resonance. Whereas this case is just, you know, keeping it there. So why is it the same?
Well, those give you, let's see, one gives you a lower limit, one gives you an upper limit, right? And
turns out that a very small range of Q, you know, less than order of magnitude, to cover the whole gamut of possibilities. In other words, if you need a small Q, Jupiter and Earth moving satellites into resonance from there. And also, if you believe the systems anywhere near the equilibrium and calculating the dissipation of yield, you might do some Jupiter. Why you need it when they come down is the high dissipation in the satellites is destroying the resonance. It's decreasing the exit distance and driving them in. And if you don't have enough torque from Jupiter, that time scale is very short. And you wouldn't see the resonances at all. So you still need the torque from Jupiter, regardless of how you form this system. You still need a Q on the other end of the distance.
The upper limit is from a completely different reason. So it seems it's surprising that it's such a small range.
Well, if you drew a graph of migration, you know, bulk of all the satellites are hooked up in resonance, and how far do they migrate as a function of Q-Jupiter? And once you get above 10 to the 6, then you migrate to a few percent of the orbital distance right now. And we got into playing the lower bound, how far you can push it, because if it's too low, then the yield will be too close to you. So 4.6 times 10 to the 9th years, you can only move the yield a certain distance. And that puts the lower bound on Q about 6 times 10 to the 4. You know, that's an average, that's a historical average. And that does not necessarily return to Q. But there's an interesting model by Stevenson, the name of Stevenson, the Congress.
No, you can say it.
No,
you can talk about it.
Taking your
steam, that's fine. So that's what Stan was about to say was that there is still, you know, if you have a Q of that order, you still have a problem because if you believe the currently measured heat flux from EO is very large, and if you say that it's in equilibrium, if the current situation is actually in equilibrium, then actually you need a Q that's much, what was it, two times 10 to the 4, which is actually below any bound. And so one possibility would be that sort of so you may actually have QJ on that order of 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6, but that as EO is deeper or less deep, so it's also oscillating about some equilibrium configuration. And what you're seeing now is basically a situation where in the phase stage where it's looking like trying to get out of resonance, but it eventually stop and come back and go back deeper into the resonance again.
The key to approaching Congress and Stevens in the model is some experimental observations that the Q becomes very temperature dependent as you approach the solidus temperature.
Q of EO.
Q of EO. As you approach the solidus temperature, it becomes exponentially dependent on the temperature. Goes down. And so their idea is the following, that if EO is cool, its Q is high, and therefore Jupiter is winning and pushing EO deeper into the resonance. In the process of pushing it deeper into the resonance, you necessarily have to increase the eccentricities in order to maintain the resonance, because the difference between N1 minus 2 and 2 is n smaller. Therefore, you have to reduce the angular velocity of the periaps things at to keep the resonant configuration. And that angular velocity goes inversely as the eccentricity. So you have to increase the eccentricity to keep the resonant configuration intact. And so if EO is cool, Jupiter's winning, pushing the deep resonance, the eccentricity goes up, the dissipation goes up. eventually you start softening the field. And so then you have this temperature dependence, the dissipation zooms way up. Okay? And now yield's winning. And more dissipated, it's decreasing eccentricity faster than Jupiter can increase eccentricity by pushing it deep in the resonance. So it's now coming out of the resonance. And that's what we see with there.
How long is a cycle?
Okay, they have a constraint because they can do the model of various Qs of Jupiter on how fast it's expanding the orbits. And if you choose Q of 10 to the sixth, they can't get you to go through the current configuration with from the experimental data as far as the temperature dependence on this theory. But Q of 10 to the fifth works fine. With Q of 10 to the fifth, it will be passing through the current configuration, and over history, it's quiescent for periods of 200 million years, and then active for periods of 30 million years in that order. And of course, there's a lot of parameters you can fiddle with to make that variation. That's the order of magnitude of the variation. And so EO is never in equilibrium. It's either going in or coming out. But Jupiter wins on the average. It's still pushing the whole set of orbits out. The energy eventually comes in rotation of Jupiter. So it's an interesting model, and sort of faded on that. But we're waiting for Phil over there to solve the two problems. They may do it. Well, Phil can expound on that. So it depends on looking for three modes of oscillation and resonance.
Well, that's all I have to say.